You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Nasi Nichols. I'm the RSA's Director of Global. It's my great pleasure to welcome you to this evening's special evening event. We're celebrating the third year of Grand Curriculum Designs, the professional development programme for teachers. Grand Curriculum Designs is led in partnership with UCL's Institute of Education. We set up Grand Curriculum Designs in 2012 to help schools to make the most out of new curricular freedoms that the coalition government promised to all schools. In that time, we've supported around 80 schools, 80 primary and secondary teachers to design curricula that are flexible, innovative and responsive to the needs of each school's students and communities. We're currently recruiting for the 2015-2016 cohort, which will begin in November. After a lecture in July which focused on secondary school education, which is really worth watching in case you're interested, tonight we brought together an expert panel to focus on primary schools. So it's my great pleasure to welcome Dominique Wise, Professor of Early Childhood and Education at UCL's Institute of Education. Dominique joins us today to talk about pupil-centred curriculum design, which draws on evidence from a range of disciplines. We're thrilled to have a distinguished panel ready to respond to Dominic's address, and we're looking forward to hearing how their thoughts on what helps primary schools to occupy their curriculum will look like. Joining Dominic today is Roddy Fairclough, head teacher at Newbury Park Primary School, Shauna Wright, middle school principal at the International School of Geneva, the first and original one, and my colleague Jo Hallgarten, who directs the RSA's Creative Learning and Development Programme. After we hear from our panel, there'll be a short cross-panel discussion, or not, depending on the time, and then we will open up to the floor for questions. So without further ado, I'll hand over to Dominic.
Thank you very much. I last spoke at the RSA on curriculum a good few years ago, could be 4 or 5 years ago, on a conference called What's So Special About Subjects? And that question is still in my mind and has been, but not today. And thank you for the introduction about pupils. I do hope I talk about pupils at some point. But how did we get here? Well, I'm going to have to be brief. I'm going to have to say things that may feel to you as if I've not finished the sentence, but it's because of the clock ticking away. How did we get here? I would say by ideology. And by the way, I don't think that's terribly good. And I'll give some examples as I go through, which I hope will illustrate my take on ideology. Where should we go next? Well, in a sense, that's for everyone in the room, of course. That's a democratic imperative, in my view. But I have a few thoughts of my own. Anyone of you who knows me won't be surprised to hear that, and I guess that's partly why I've been invited to talk. So, the four areas to very briefly address something that myself and some colleagues are calling current certainties. Again, not necessarily a good thing. They're kind of received wisdom. They're things that have been happening actually in some cases since 1988, since the Education Reform Act, since the Blair governments of the 1990s. They're almost certainties, but actually some of us want to resist that idea that they should be certainties. I suppose if there's one theme that goes through tonight and a lot of my work over the last few years, it's the thinking that I'm doing about what we call performativity. In other words, the influence of high-stakes testing on the curriculum, as an example. And I want to I start with a little bit directly about England and, in fact, London, and then quickly zoom out to think more globally, and you'll see why I'm just another cheap plug for one of my books, which I apologise for doing on the way through a couple of times. New visions. I hope that I can offer some new visions. They're not my own. I love working in partnership with people, with teachers, with academics, and creating new visions. And we've had a go. And they led to what we've called a manifesto for change. So, without further ado, let me launch in. I just want to read you the words of this North London teacher, a nursery teacher. We've been told by the head that the EYFS is no longer a stage in its own right, looking holistically at young children. merely a precursor to Key Stage 1. So formal learning is now coming down from Year 1. We're explicitly asked to make nursery more formal. More formal means more direct teaching of maths and phonics. The effects of us spending more time on teaching maths and phonics mean we spend less time supporting the children in free flow, child-initiated play. In my school, the EYFS has been pressured into becoming a clone of Key Stage 1. The philosophy and values of the EYS are being eroded. Yes, it's only one teacher, although it's part of a small study that a colleague of mine did looking at the issue of how do things like the phonics screening check affect the curriculum and the activities of the classroom. Yes, that's about early years, but you can see I'm trying to join up the dots, another one of my sort of projects really, between the early years and primary education. They are distinct phases in England, but they're not in lots of countries. And the question of whether they should be distinct phases, if you think about child development, if you think about any children that you've taught, or your own children, or whatever children you know, they don't, of course, fit into these neat legal compartments of educational phases. But much more worrying is this sense that this teacher has. Yes, it might be exaggerated because it was a formal interview for a research project, but it's certainly a view I'm hearing more and more. In fact, even today, as we sat down in the room before we came in here, that was one of the topics that immediately came to mind for some of us. Ideology, I said I'd talk about. Well, I suppose the first slide was one of the effects of ideology, perhaps. Here's just one. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of examples of education ministers of different political parties making statements that, to me, are utterly rooted in ideology rather than, a nuanced view of the history of educational ideas, or even based on rigorous research or theory. And less still, actually, even about the culture and practice of schools, which is also well understood not only from the people who do the work, the teachers, the head teachers, but also from certain kinds of researchers who pay attention. Phonics tests show progressive teaching is doomed to failure. Lots of kind of important use of language, admittedly mediated by the Daily Telegraph. I suppose I can't help but notice also the picture of the child, who looks slightly scary. But then when you look closely, you see that it says, posed by model. So, forgiven, but I'm afraid it does kind of sum up some of this. And the claim, well, let's deal with progressive teaching is doomed. So there's a kind of lazy equating, really, of anything that's not deemed by ministers with Nick Gibbs' views. There's a kind of demonization of anything that doesn't fit their models. And progressive teaching is regularly pilloried. I mean, I think if you said to somebody, well, what exactly is progressive teaching? There's a very long and difficult conversation to be had because it's certainly not straightforward. Doomed to failure. Now, of course, the reason I've chosen phonics is not just my personal research interest, although that's part of it. It's because it's symbolic, it seems to me, of a lot of things that are happening in early years and primary education. It's certainly more than symbolic in terms of high-stakes testing. I don't think you can get more high stakes than making the nation's six-year-old children all be tested at the same time through nonsense words. I mean, if that's not, and then, of course, all the implications that come out of that. But what I always do and have done over my career is to say, well, okay, let's look at the evidence behind this. Now, the debates about reading are contentious, although actually I think there is more consensus than there was, say, 20 years ago, even among the academic community who love a good argument. But let's take this specific point. Nick Gibbs' claim is that the phonics screening test is a good thing. Even his own evaluation that the NFVR carried out does not, as you can see from the quote, does not support his contention. And if you read between the lines of the report, what's striking is it feels as though he's almost breathing down the researcher's neck, saying, well, okay, you can't say this categorically, but it might be true, mightn't it? If you read the report, it really does feel like that. The evidence said, as the quote makes clear, that the analysis of the scores in the data sets were not conclusive, and that there were no improvements in attainment or in progress that could be clearly attributed to the introduction of the phonics screening check. It does also say that there was evidence of improvement in attainment, but that would take us into an extremely complex and lengthy area of the extent to which education in a country has improved over time. And it's very difficult to answer that question, although there are lots of rather interesting pieces of research that have attempted to do that. A small example of ideology and performativity. I said I would jump to global trends, and I will. In fact, I'll jump all over the place, it appears with the slides. So, Andreas Schleicher, the architect of the PISA tests that are so influential, these league tables of countries around the world. I'm very happy that he agreed to write a chapter in this thing. It's a two-volume set of 62 chapters that myself and two other colleagues, one in the States and one in Scotland, have edited. And Schleicher did a chapter, and it's a very good chapter, and it's really interesting because it's very well informed, of course, about the methodology of the tests. It's also, to some degree, recognises the limitations. So it's interesting. But he says this: in a globalised world, the yardsticks for success are no longer national goals or standards, but the performance of the most successful education systems internationally. I beg to differ. And there are questions around, actually, so what if one country is 10 places above another? Is it the most appropriate way to compare? And I'm not the only person asking that kind of question. So Esther Kerr and Bruce Bezick in Australia do another very interesting chapter, very different take on this whole question. It's all about how should we compare? What's the value of comparing? And what can we learn by appropriate, rigorous comparison of the education systems of different countries? And the criticism that Kerr and Bezick make is on the grounds of that PISA claims cultural neutrality. In PISA's defence, I would say they do take efforts to think about language and culture to some degree, but I accept the criticism that it's not enough. And they go on to say, you know, the commonality and the measurement and the constructs used to measure are, in the end, perhaps not appropriate, particularly for their uses by politicians. Now, the people running the tests can't be blamed for the way politicians use league tables and data in the way they do. Another example, same topic, performativity, this time from Japan. I won't read through the whole quote, but I was really struck by this academic from Japan who took the idea, Beck's sociological idea of risk, and applied that to what she claims is the influence of performativity on the curriculum in Japan. And essentially, of course, it's a long, complex argument in a chapter of 8,000 words, but what really struck me was how she was able to take the idea of performativity and bring it right down to the teachers in the classroom and to a topic. And the topic she chose to focus on was about the disaster, the Fukushima power plant disaster. I was quite surprised that it was 2001. It seems so much more recent somehow. The people who died, it's dreadful. The people missing, I wasn't aware of. But she said there is a requirement to teach about this disaster, the children of Japan. But she says you can't just teach it as content. It's got to be taught in a way that takes account of the politics. And as I've highlighted in red, this issue cannot be managed with packaged classroom teaching focused purely on achieving the targeted competencies and skills. So in addition to her academic argument, she goes right down to the level of the classroom to show why performativity has an effect and why there are better things that we should be doing with different nations' children. In brief, a colleague at the IOE, relatively new colleague, I've known her for 4 years, wrote a chapter for the Current Certainties book and did a wonderful project with children and a teacher using, where essentially they used Flickr to post images that matter to them. And this little toy gemstone became a kind of I don't know, it became a metaphor for the project. The kids got very excited, so excited to the point that the girl whose image it was got fed up with them asking about it. So it really took on a life of its own. But I suppose it's a tiny example, I guess, of different ways of how we might be, how we might be in the classroom, how the curriculum might be. And not surprisingly, it was derived from the children's interests, the teacher's interests, and my colleague Lynn's interests. So, I said I'd get to a manifesto for change, and I'm kind of summarising these ideas came from a period of 2 years of work with colleagues who were both researchers and teacher trainers, thinking about how things might be different in terms of primary education and early years education. I think we've got a massive problem with high-stakes testing. Where I think there's consensus, I'm hearing more people say this is a problem than it is an advantage. And by the way, as a researcher, I can see quite a few advantages, but that's a bit selfish. In my view, in terms of the curriculum, and the national curriculum in particular, in England, I don't think we've got the balance right between the state's requirements and the opportunity that we have as teachers and people with an interest in society, and children's interests as well, to have the curriculum that they want. And one can go back to Dewey on this and others. I still think the important idea of evidence-informing practice is we're still struggling. We're making progress, and I noticed that Mary James is here, who's done a very good account through the BIRA website of how difficult it can be to get evidence in the minds of the policymakers. And I couldn't agree more that that is a challenge. And finally, where are the children's voices in their own curriculum? I remember years ago when one of the early national curriculums was developed, and actually a Quango, something like QCA, did do a serious attempt to ask children the kind of curriculum they wanted. We certainly didn't ask them about current English national curriculum. I think teachers have precious little time to say things to children like, what would you like to learn today? What are you interested in? Okay, let's develop some work around that. But there may be people here who will challenge me on that. Thank you. Thank you.
So thank you very much, Dominic, for that. It was a fantastic introduction to the debate that we're about to have. I said early on that we had a panel who were going to give their perspectives on how, as school leaders, either from their own experiences or from those that they know, they have shaped curriculum and assessment models to raise standards and performance. What I'd like to do is invite Roddy to comment first, either on what you've heard and also on your own experiences.
Okay, thank you very much. Good evening, everyone. I'll try and do a bit of both if I've got time. I am going to be stopped by the lady on my right, so if I stop mid-sentence, I apologise for that. I've been a head teacher for 5 years. My career is from 1996 to the present day, and I've taught and been a head teacher solely in London, West London, East London. So I feel as though I have a good perspective on the education system in London. I've joined the debate more recently around curriculum change, and I feel that reading the literature and the context that I'm in, I feel that we have to make a decision as to whether we're a more traditionalist approach to curriculum change or whether it's more progressive. And I don't think that's right. And I tend to agree with Chris Husband's view, who's the director of the UCL Institute of Education, in that, yes, we have to acquire knowledge. You know, we have to acquire knowledge, but it's not just about knowledge. As a head teacher, what motivates me is the engagement with children and how we acquire knowledge, but engaging pupils in their learning in the classroom and out of the classroom on a daily basis. And one of the key things he also says is that, okay, you've got knowledge and you've got skills, but with the advancements of technology and the rapid rate of change of the education system in the UK, it's not just about that, because the children that I'm teaching now, when they grow up, they will be doing jobs that don't even exist and that I don't have a clue about myself. And so we have to build resilience in children, even through their primary years. And we have to develop their understanding about applying skills in a future that we don't necessarily know about. And for me as an educationalist, that's just as important as being accountable to what Dominic talked about, performativity and high-stakes testing. And one of the challenges for head teachers currently is this perceived autonomy that we can channel our own curriculum. In certain terms, is a perception, because the accountability stakes take over. And whether you've got a syllabus or a curriculum, you're kind of governed by the testing at the end of it. And if you've, if you can remember the A levels that you took way back when, you kind of ignored the syllabus. You just looked at the tests and you wanted to kind of focus on what do I need to do to pass that test? Because I need to get to college, I want to get to university, I want to pass. And it steers you down the wrong route. And I think we just need a better balance. We just need a better understanding about that.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. So building resilience in primary years in an uncertain world. Shona, you run an international school, presumably with a lot of people that come from very different backgrounds. Mm-hmm. So what's your take on this?
Okay, well, good evening. I'm not at all an expert on the UK national curriculum, so I hope I'm not a fraud being here, but I hope I can share another perspective coming from a school where we were lucky enough to be able to develop our own curriculum and assessment without any top-down prescribed curriculum. My school in Geneva, the International School of Geneva, Geneva being the international city, the European headquarters of the United Nations, we have 140 nationalities and over 80 mother tongues in the school, so a very diverse population. And teaching these students, talking, as Dominic was talking about, student-centered curriculum, our job is to try to teach each of these children to potentially return to a variety of national and other international schools. And so we do that really broadly speaking in three ways, and Dominic's Manifesto for Change really spoke to me, because I think all of those four things we're really trying to do. We're not perfect, but we're working at it. One important part that we really is priority is there's probably three elements that I could speak briefly about. Character is the most important. What is education for if it's not to develop good human beings who can contribute to society? The rest of it is fairly meaningless. So the most important part of everything that we do is building character with children, including service learning, learning how to live together, to feel safe, to take risks, to build community in a world where individualism is becoming more and more prominent, more and more narcissistic, the age of the selfie. Really, that's the priority, empathy and character. The second thing is to have a curriculum that's not built around content. It's really built around competencies. As Roddy was saying, our children, most of the top 10 jobs right now apparently didn't exist in 2004. So when the students I'm teaching now graduate in 2025 from university, who knows what they'll be doing? So what we need to do is give them the skills to collaborate, to be creative, to take risks, to work together in teams, to solve problems, to transfer knowledge from one area to another and apply it. So those are really the competences we're working on, very briefly. The final thing is the content. Disciplines are still important. Obviously, academic and mathematical literacy is still important, but largely speaking, the content is a vehicle for the skills. And broadly speaking, if any of you are familiar with Howard Gardner's Five Minds for the Future, I'd like to think a bit in the sense of the character part is the respectful and the ethical mind. The competencies part is the creative mind and the synthesizing mind. And the content part is the disciplined mind. So assessment, finally, in my last few seconds, we're very fortunate because we don't give grades, we don't give levels. Assessment is for learning. Children, we really want the children to reflect, to have peer assessment, and then to have feedback from the teacher, from their peers, and from themselves as to the next stage in their learning. So that's really our philosophy. That's what we're trying to do. It's not always easy, but I take heart for national systems from countries like Finland, where they've stopped inspections, they've stopped standardized testing. They've started trusting teachers to make pedagogical decisions based on research and training their teachers very well. And I would love to see that happen. One final comment. The RSA's paper last year, Schools with Soul, I think really makes this same plea. And I hope that more will come of that in the future.
Lovely.
Thank you.
Thank you. I was in Finland last week, actually, and they were telling me their education system is the best in the world. And I said, why is that? And they said, because our teachers have autonomy and freedom. So on that note, Joe, how would you make happen here?
Yeah, is it possible to get Dominic's final slide up? I think it would be really useful. It really contributes to the debate, the manifesto, just so people can refer to it. Dominic's point about... First of all, I'm going to talk a lot about curriculum power, who should decide rather than what should be in it in terms of curriculum. And his point about a children's voice reminded me of my only and probably failed curriculum experiment when I was a primary school teacher. At a point of end of summer, end of year six inertia, I asked the kids to decide what they wanted to learn over half a term they wanted to focus on. And the two most popular choices were first aid and self-defence. I'd always wondered what they said about my classroom management and behaviour style and so on. But in terms of this debate, it's called Occupy Your Curriculum. And when you think of the Occupy movement, I always think of that wonderful phrase, we're the 99%. And in terms of this debate, this is not evidence-based at all. But I think that despite this government's promise on giving schools greater curricular freedom, my guess is 99% of primary schools feel more constrained than they did 5 years ago about their curriculum choices. Now, when I say curriculum choices, I think real curriculum design is not just about freedom within the national curriculum. It's about giving schools genuine protected space to define their own priorities for learning that can complement what's nationally prescribed. So if schools are constrained in this way, and I'd love to be refuted in a way, does this matter? Perhaps government and all its levers are forcing primary schools to focus on the right things, particularly improved expectations in literacy and numeracy. And I'd say it does matter in two ways. First of all, intrinsically, regardless of whether it raises attainment, I just think it's a fundamental right for schools and teachers to have greater collective agency, and that means collective agency with their pupils and with their communities, over what they teach. But secondly, instrumentally, what we're learning from the Grand Curriculum Designs Programme and other programmes similar is that the process that you go through as a leader to design your curriculum is itself a school improvement tool. It forces you to define and communicate your purpose and ethos, and it also gives teachers the inquiry and innovation skills that can both make them better teachers but also keep them teaching as well, which is crucial in this period of really difficult recruitment and retention. The few more points I've learned from Grand Curriculum Designs, I think the most important one is about assessment. I think if you don't assess, a terrible thing happens. What I mean by that is if you really do value those outcomes that go beyond the national curriculum, whether it's creativity, whether it's character, whether it's everything else, I think you need to be brave to think about how you assess them. And I mean assessment in terms of helping learners understand where they are against those outcomes. Thinking of assessment, as Rinaldi does in Reggio Emilia, as an act of love. Our idea around that I'd love to just to pitch to you quickly in terms of primary schools is RSA is very keen on developing a middle years baccalaureate for age 9 to 13 year olds to help those young people understand and celebrate where they are against those outcomes, celebrating and assessing what they do in school and out of school as a means of promoting different kinds of parental engagement and also different types of transition. It's a very half-formed idea, not half-baked but half-formed, but I'd love to get people's reaction to that. Thank you.
Lovely. We'll ask about that. Thank you very much. So I just have one question, then I'm going to open it up to the audience. Rudy, you said that we need to have a better balance. A better balance is needed. But you made a very good point that accountability and the incentive structure that we work towards will determine and dictate our activities and what we focus on. So given that this discussion is about how to occupy your curriculum, and let's assume that there's going to be no mass governmental intervention, how do you go about doing it?
Great question. I have to say that I do feel that there is a sense of opportunity here. It just gets stifled in the rate of change and the busyness of you know, the education system in schools today. And the idea of taking risks and being brave is actually a real one. And I think if schools, leadership teams, teachers could just speak with more conviction. And when Ofsted come knocking on the door with their set of criteria and their judgments, that schools, in the right framework, can actually respond. And sometimes it's okay to go, Mr. Inspector, no, I think you're wrong. We know our school, we know the children in our school, and we've designed a curriculum for them because it's about them, and teachers and leaders are the vehicle to enable that to happen. And if you don't have child-centred learning, I don't quite know where you go. And so I've started at a new school. We have the opportunity to completely radically change the way we think about our curriculum for our pupils. And our pupils are the majority from an Asian background. Their parents are very positive about education. Many of the children do have tutors outside of school, and they fiercely want their children to do well. But as children, they are quite passive in their learning. If the children in my school were transplanted into more of an urban setting, they'd find it quite difficult, because the children in my school will sit on the carpet for 30 to 40 minutes and listen to what the class teacher has got to say. And across the school, some class teachers have got a lot to say that's important, but some class teachers have got a lot to say and it's just complete and utter drivel. And if you put those, if you took children from an urban setting and put them in our school, some of my teachers wouldn't last 5 minutes. So it is all about the context and the children and where they are coming from. And if we start from them and what they need and design the curriculum around that and the community, then we're going places, I think.
And Dominic, if I could just get your thoughts.
I was interested, actually, can I pick up on something that you said about the sitting on the carpet, actually? Yeah. It is an absolute worry of mine, and I'm not going in and observing teaching as much as I used to, but I do remember seeing so many minutes, hours in the child's life sat listening. And even if it's a really good teacher, and even if the interaction is strong, informed, knowledgeable, sensitive, I still think there's a problem with sitting on the carpet for 30 minutes. It might not be a terribly profound thing, but it really did ring a bell for me, actually. And also, maybe even more seriously, I think the point about agency is really important. Agency and autonomy. And also, I think what you're saying about confidence. There are schools, as we probably all know them, with strong and confident head teachers who are confident of the idea of teachers as professional people who make decisions. And at this point, I always say, does the government say to your GP, no, you must do it like this, or your consultant? Or do they say it to your lawyer? And if not, why not? And what are the similarities and differences? So, a few thoughts.
Interesting. And then finally, Shauna, you work in a very different environment where you have been able to set the curriculum, but you still have had to come up with a framework for it. What kind of impact have you seen that have on the teachers in particular, and I suppose the way in which they teach?
Well, I mean, we're fortunate to work with some really incredible teachers. And I think you're talking about pedagogy as well. For me, there's two things. The curriculum is what is important for children to learn, but then what do we know about how we learn best? Again, it's applying the research, and we know that active learning, especially, I'm a middle school teacher, but the final primary years, we know children need to learn actively. We know that their tailbone is not even fused till year 9. They shouldn't be sitting on the carpet or a chair for 30 minutes. And so it's about developing that pedagogy and not accepting too much passive learning. But basically, the teachers who I work with, I think they contributed. The agency and autonomy thing is very important. As Joe made the point about the actual process of building the curriculum is a professional development in itself. Because we had very interesting discussions and debates, some very heated, because we were also developing a curriculum that's in English and French. The way you teach maths in French is very different to in English. And so that led to all kinds of very passionate exchanges between the teachers. to find some kind of compromise. And if we're trying to teach children how to work with other people, we modelled that in building our curriculum. So I think it gave the teachers agency and autonomy and motivation over the curriculum. They felt they owned it. And then also the drive to make sure that the students have ownership in the curriculum, that autonomy is also applied to the children as a student's voice in the curriculum, student-led curriculum, student choice in activities, and so on.
Lovely. Thank you. I'd like to open the floor to questions. If you do have a question, please raise your hand.
Hello, I'm a school governor at a primary school in Southeast London. No, Southwest. When we're looking at assessment and when we're looking at creating expectations for our students, I have quite a deprived group of children that come from our school, including, you know, children that are children of failed refugees and have very unstable sort of lives. But we also have, you know, as you say, very dedicated immigrant parents who are really, really passionate about what goes on in our school and even want us to do more and more homework and things like that. But I worry sometimes without some sort of national structure or some sort of programme, how do we make sure some of these groups of children aren't left behind? And that because in the past, I think this society has been very classist and it has distinguished there are poor schools for poor children and we invest less in them. And so if you don't have, if you go off and everyone has their own curriculum, how do we ensure that there aren't sort of backwater schools that just forget about their children and just use some sort of bog standard thing? How do we keep that momentum up?
William?
It reminds me of one of the two or three pillars of the original national curriculum in 1988, the idea of entitlement. But what always struck me about entitlement is a uniform curriculum is not necessarily one that gives the best entitlement. Actually, a differentiated curriculum arguably can give greater entitlement because these different groups, and I have been privileged, I started my teaching career in London and taught in Bradford and Huddersfield, where in each context, the different communities had their own interests, needs, and things that we could tap into. So I'm less worried, if you are worried, about the kind of framing, because I think what we've had too much over the last 20 to 30 years is far too much framing. And so I think the greater evil is the lack of autonomy rather than the worry that somehow children won't get what they need.
Yeah, I mean, the first thing is we've had a national structure for over 25 years and it hasn't actually done much to reduce the gap. So whatever it was intended to do there for the type of children that you're teaching, it hasn't really succeeded. But the other thing is, I think, and we kind of need to repeat, anyone who's kind of for progressive education in various ways, there's certain things you need to repeat again and again. And the first thing is, I'm not arguing against knowledge and subject knowledge. I think it's really important. And actually, I think older primary children could possibly benefit from more subject knowledge and more subject specialist teaching within that. I'm not arguing against the national curriculum at all. And I'm not arguing against any type of inspection process and accountability process either, which also makes sure that schools like yours might not slip through the net. I'm just arguing for turning down the volume on all of those. So turn down the volume on knowledge slightly and turn it up around skills and broader competencies. Turn down the volume on the national curriculum so that other curricula can emerge as a result. And turn down the volume on national inspection, so other forms of outward accountability can grow to your community rather than just an upward accountability in this horrible food chain from school to governor to Ofsted to government.
Okay, thank you.
I'm Terry Lowe, and I'm in my 44th year as an educator. It's more of an observation, I think, rather than a question. It strikes me that there's quite a lot of consensus about turning down the volume, as you say. There's quite a lot of consensus about moving away from the exam factory approach, both in this room and also, I think, out there. 3 years ago, when there was all the fuss about GCSE English, which you might remember, somebody on the Any Questions programme suggested they should get rid of all exams at 16, and then they had to stop for a minute while the audience applauded. So my question is this: why, when there is so much consensus to turn down the volume on performativity and exam factories, why is it not happening?
I, as a head teacher, decisions that you sometimes have to make become based on moral imperative. And when difficult decisions have to be made, I always look to my inner self and make a decision on what, why am I here? What am I trying to achieve? And if it's the right decision for me, I'll make it despite what anybody else says. And you always come to a point where you will sometimes have to make a decision based on that. Now, I go back to my childhood. I go back to my experiences at school, and the education system failed me personally as a child. So when I think about testing, when I think about GCSEs and A-levels, they fit a certain body of child, but one size does not fit all. And I'm not against testing. I think we have to have tests. I think they are important. They're also a safety net. But I just think the testing needs to be thought through a bit more. And it's a little bit one-dimensional. I think you can arrange and organise testing that can demonstrate an acquisition of knowledge. I think you could organise testing so that it can demonstrate a skill base and how you apply those skills. But there doesn't seem to be the rhetoric or the force of power to go down that line. I don't know whether that answers your question, but it's where I'm coming from. And I think we should be thinking more along those lines rather than this just very, very narrow focus on a test, one exam, because it's not the answer. There's not one way that I think we should have a multitude of ways.
Okay. Joe, did you have some thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, in this building, one of the first ever public examinations for the masses, if you like, was invented beyond the elite. The typing examinations and others came from this building, and there is something equalising about that those processes. In terms of 16, the two most recent people that said end exams at 16 were Kenneth Baker and the head of the CBI. So there is a powerful argument, powerful supporters for that. And I think the raised participation age to 19, it's been a missed opportunity to really think about what an educated 19-year-old should look like and then think backwards from that. Why do we never get so far on this? It must be something about all of our kind of deep insecurity about, particularly about the labour market, I think about the labour market our children are entering. I'm slightly sceptical about those jobs that don't exist yet, stats, I must admit. But I think generally, as parents and employers, we're really worried about an unstable labour market and what it means for our children. And it forces us to retreat to kind of known knowns rather than take risks. I just don't know how to get over that. But it is something about building some parental and taxpayer will for change.
Okay, thank you. Shauna, I mean, you were the one that in your school, you mentioned that. You know, you are very conscious that the jobs of the future, you're not really too sure what they're going to be. But kind of just drawing on what Joe has said, which is that with this uncertainty, it forces us to retreat to things that we know. Is that the experience that you see?
Not in my context, no. But I think to answer your question, being away from the UK system for probably almost 19 years now, I think that you're so trapped in this context where high stakes testing, funding came with it, judgments, school league tables, that it's terrifying to look beyond it. But we know from all of the research that kind of assessment does not improve learning, that you've just shown us some of the statistics. We know that the kind of pedagogy that does have an impact on learning is much harder to test in a quantitative way. We're having discussions right now at my school, key performance indicators. How do we know externally? How do we view how well we're doing? Because it's very intangible, working together, collaborating, creativity, all of those things. But we have to be brave enough, I think, to do it anyway, because we know it works from the research. And it's scary when you've lived in a system for 20 years with standardized testing. But follow Finland again.
I think it's about mobilisation of the voting public until the votes hurt the politicians. So this has to become an issue of massive importance in a general election, a local election, and so on. I think there's an issue to do with educating many people in this room, obviously, understand some of the issues to do with assessment, but actually there's some complexities there. The biggest problem, I think, is confusion of purposes. So we're confusing accountability with the need to genuinely assess how children are learning. I think that's an education, sort of education of wider society job.
Okay, brilliant. Thank you, Dominic. Here's a question.
Hello. Yes. I run a small company called Futurebind, which works in consultancy and all sorts of schools all over the UK. And Shauna, may I ask you a question, and may I also make a comment? I think this question that you asked about, why are we still in this mindset where things don't work? If you look at the Hadow report in 31, they talk about that some of it's very beautiful language about what makes a beautiful learning environment. And that was 1931. You know, and we're still here. Here we are doing the same thing around and around and around. Now, here's a school, like many others, I'm sure, that are experimenting and are in places where they can be free to do things. Do you have anyone coming from the UK to your environment? And if you do, do they survive? And how do they find it? And how long does it take to create that environment in the first place?
You,
sorry, that was about 10 questions,
students,
wasn't it?
Children.
No, well, I meant teachers. I meant teachers.
Interesting. We were just saying earlier to Joe and the others, we do. We have teachers from all over the world, but the UK included. And honestly, they feel the way I felt when I first went to an international school as a teacher. At the time, it was Frankfurt. Now I can do all the things that I've been reading about and I wanted to do. And one teacher, a year six teacher with me, said, who came from a school in East London, wonderful teacher, said to me, it's just so amazing not to see my kids white and stressed out because I have to test them constantly. Those were his very words. He can be creative, he can let them play, he can let them learn in project-based ways, different kind of ways. It's not paradise, it's a lot of work. It brings other stresses, and we're not perfect. We're far from perfect. But I believe it is a much more child-centred and impactful learning environment than a more constrained one.
Just to say one thing, it staggers me actually as well that when you compare two photographs of a classroom from 100 years ago and now, and you do the same to a hospital theatre, the classrooms, you even ask children to analyse and compare and contrast, and children can see the many more similarities with classrooms when they look at the hospital theatre and what was going on 100 years ago to now. They're completely different worlds, and I don't understand why that is and why education hasn't progressed a lot more faster than it has.
I'm an ex-school governor, primary governor, and I admit was head of communications for the School Curriculum Assessment Authority, SCAR, a long time ago at National Curriculum Days. Just a question about governance. What's the potential role of governors in occupying your curriculum? I mean, they, in theory, if you want to mobilise the electorate, mobilising governors, that's a very powerful structure. And I know I certainly always felt incredibly underutilised, incapable of getting outside of the kind of the framework that was dictated to us. And yet I feel as governors, we have a responsibility actually for the care and performance of our schools, not according to the league tables, but as our proper duty. I care of governance in that context and whether there is anything happening in people's sense of that.
Hi, I'm Arlene Holmes-Henderson. I am an academic in language education policy. My question is for Shauna. You gave us this great statistic. The top 10 jobs of 2015 didn't exist in 2004. I tweeted this and some randomer has asked the question, measured by what?
Okay.
Hi, I've recently become head of an independent pre-prep and nursery school, an infant and nursery school. Obviously, as an independent school, we have slightly more freedom with our curriculum. And I just wanted to ask a slightly selfish and more practical question. Roddy, you talked about bringing in radical change in the curriculum. I just wanted to ask how you find the time to do this with your teachers and sort of from a practical point of view, how you go about organising that and what sort of timescale you work with. Is it something you do gradually in phases or with this radical change be done in one swoop, as it were?
First of all, I don't have the time. It's down to, in my opinion, it's down to professional development. It's down to a clarity around understanding the process of change. and having an awareness of that and communicating that with staff. Because what I found is that when you're trying to implement any new program or change things, people, first of all, get a bit uneasy. And if you don't, you know, clarify what the real purpose and the aims are, or give some idea of what it might look like, and go through that process of communication, you're going to find it really difficult. Having said that, it's still difficult. But one of the things that I recently carried out some research, an MA into Ofsted inspections, and this autonomy versus accountability aspect. And what one of the key things is being clear about what you're going to focus on, because you can't focus on everything. And if curriculum change is the key essence of what you're doing, you've got to put other things on hold. And that's very difficult, because teachers operate operationally, and leaders are at a strategic level, and you have to look at that very, very clearly. And so what I do, it's all about professional development. It's developing a program for that, a stepped approach, and being very clear about what those steps are, and also saying to teachers, it's okay when things go wrong. It's going to be messy. Learning is messy, and we don't have all the answers, and that's where risk comes in. And if you don't build trust between practitioners and between leaders, if you don't build that trust, it's not going to happen, and that's the difficult part. That's the cultural shift in making any real transformational change.
Thank you, Ollie. Shauna, do you know where the stat came from?
Yeah, in fact, exactly from my head of curriculum, just on Monday night at a parents' evening, and she's very research-based. So I asked her, said, well, off the record, I said to her, what are some of these? She mentioned two, which were apps developer and a sustainability expert. I don't know who the other eight, what the other eight are, I'm afraid, but I shall promise I shall try and find out from her.
Maybe you can let us know when you can tweet
exactly.
It. And then, Joe, what's the role of governors in occupying the curriculum?
First of all, very quickly on time, one of the teachers, doesn't really answer your question, one of the head teachers on our programme talks about in an 8-week term, he gets teachers to plan for 6 and leave the last two completely clear, because then you've got time either to reinforce what hasn't been learned or to step out and into what you need some deeper learning around. And that's a really kind of useful and practical tip. In terms of governors, they're underutilised, but it's hard to get power as a governor. I've been governor in 2 schools, and I just basically pick one battle, and one battle teaches me one subject. So in one school, I was the PE guy. You know, I just went in every single meeting. I just talked about, why aren't they doing enough PE? At the moment, I'm the music guy. Oh God, here's the music guy. He's going to bang on about music again. But that's all I can. It feels like that's all I can do. And there is the power thing in governance is really difficult. What I would say as a governor, I think there's 2 things you can do. First of all, you can give schools the confidence to say, just be good enough for Ofsted, and then be excellent on our terms. So think about what excellent means in our context. And then secondly, as governor, you don't represent the community, you represent the interests of the schools, but you can reflect the community. You can begin to understand what local employers, what others are saying about the skills that young people need, and then talk to the school about that with the authority to do that, and then hopefully that will inform some wiser and wider curriculum choices.
Lovely. And just on the governor's point, the RSA is actually creating a network of governors to help them, I suppose, have the ability collectively to advocate for more creativity. So if anyone here is a governor and also a fellow, then please come and speak to us. Sadly, ladies and gentlemen, we have run out of time. Thank you very much for coming. Thank you for your excellent questions. I'd like to thank the panel as well for their time. You can find out more about Grand Curriculum Designs and all of our work in education on our website. Have a lovely evening.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, thersa.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.